Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to StrategyPage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of StrategyPage.com, your host. Today we'll be talking to Austin Bay and Al Nofi. Austin Bay is an author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Al Nofi is a military analyst, military historian, and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. Welcome, Al and Austin. With it being the 100th anniversary of World War I this year, we thought it would be appropriate to cover that. And I know Al and Austin, you both have a lot of background in this area. And what we thought we'd try to do this first time, we're going to cover this over several episodes. But what we were hoping to do this first time is to sort of set the table for the start of World War I. And Austin, I know you have some interesting thoughts on the beginnings of World War I and how things were progressing up to 1914. Can you share those with us?
Well, it's tough to be brief with it. I think what you're referring to, Dan, is my argument, and it's not just my argument, but it's one I favor, and I certainly discuss it in that biography of Kemal Ataturk that Macmillan published a couple of years ago, and that is the clash of three decaying, and I think it's fair to call them medieval empires. Al can expand on that if he wants to, in the Balkans. I'm referring to the Romanov dynasty in Russia, Habsburgs, Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottomans, Ottoman Turkey. Now, there's clearly a colonial competition between the great powers of Europe, France and Britain really on one side, and Germany on the other. Germany's a latecomer to it. And there's also I think this is a distorting argument, which is that an arms race between Great Britain and Germany primarily, and sometimes it focuses on naval arms race. Al is actually the expert on that, is what kicks off World War I, and I think that's very distorting. Actually, I think you will see that argument made really during the Cold War, especially, and of course it was really used as, arms race bad, West shouldn't be doing it, and of course you had no control over Russia and its garb as the Soviet Union. Now, it certainly does play a role, but the three decaying medieval empires in the Balkan mess and the Balkan complications are really central. The Balkan powder keg, to employ the cliche, but it's a very accurate cliche. It's also the Balkan charnel house. You'll hear that for all the dead. That's a little bit more obscure reference, but it is used. Al just recognized it. It's absolutely critical to understanding the conflagration. Now, of course, hey, wait a minute, Sarajevo, late June 1914, and the assassination of the Austrian Archduke by Gavril Princip, Serbian ultra-nationalist, anarchist as well, how they work together. I'll let Al sort that out, but of course we've had discussions of what constitutes a 19th and early 20th century anarchist. That said, that is certainly part of the Balkan powder keg story. But I look back at the Balkans and Dan, if the 20th century ended with peacekeeping operations in the Balkans and small dirty wars in the Balkans, the late 19th century was riddled with it, and also the early 20th century. And you can even see peacekeeping operations in the Balkans in 1903, 1904. There were attempts at monitoring peace agreements between various Balkan groups and the Turks, even in the last decade of the 19th century. But there really was a major peacekeeping operation, an attempt to reform, reorganize the Turkish gendarmerie that was operating in Turkish Macedonia and Albania and the like, and also recognizing quote unquote Russia's interests in protecting the Slavs, Great Britain and France's interest. You have an Italy, and this is another key component that does get into the colonial competition in a major way. And Italy looking across the Adriatic and casting eyes once again at Croatian islands, at Albania, at also gaining colonies, and Italy is very seriously looking at Libya, which is just south of, I'll name two islands that were still under, well, it's several islands under Italian control, not far from the North African coast. The Italians were romanticizing Libya as a potential agricultural granary. Now, of course, it's got oil, and that's valuable now, but this is taking a look at a perspective of late 19th, early 20th century Italy coming late to the colonial empire game. And but it's also engaged in the Balkans and at the same time coveting Libya, and Libya is under as a Ottoman colony. Well, it's really in a protectorate status, but an Ottoman colony complete with Ottoman troops as well. So those, you see the roots of this, certainly by 1894, 1895, you have crises between Greece and Turkey. You have guerrilla actions by, well, Bulgarians, Greeks, various Muslim guerrilla bands in Albania. Many of them end up having great power or minor power sponsors. That's how they manage to stay in the field. You see Greek partisan bands that during the day they're farmers and at night they're guerrillas. Al will also say often sometimes they're just bandits, and he would be right. And you see that with the Albanians as well. I mean, the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, was a drug army and smuggling group. And I'm not just slapping at the KLA of 1998, 1999. They were just living out a tradition of whether you were Albanian, Bulgarian, Macedonian, whatever that could constitute. There's also even a Macedonian identity question in the late 19th and early 20th century, and that's still playing out, by the way, Dan. Greece insists that the Macedonians in the Republic of Macedonia call themselves the Fyrom, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. We cover that occasionally on strategy page, and certainly we were talking about it major way in 1999 and 2000, and in 2001 with the Albanian Liberation Army when they showed up waging their little war with Macedonian Slavs. But the window here for the audience is that late turn of the century decay, violence, revolution, sovereignty issues in the Balkans that we witnessed with the disintegration of Yugoslavia and the Kosovo War. But those elements were at play, building towards August 1914. And a lot of it had to do with the Turkish inability to control its European provinces. Turkish Macedonia, take a look at it on the map. It's big Thrace cuts off. I mean, they controlled Salonika. Thessaloniki was the major, actually, garrison town and major seaport for, you'll see this Ottoman Europe You'll see that as a dateline for reports from the first decade of the 20th century. Ottoman Europe, Turkish Europe, and, you know, the contest of whether it is Thessalonica or Salonika. It's the same town. Sometimes you'll see Istanbul even showing up, even at its Constantinople, and the Turks will point out, well, Istanbul is our pronunciation of Constantinople. Little known fact, but it's anyway. You had the same 1453 when the Turks took Constantinople. That comes into play in the certainly in the Greek Revolution of the 19th century, and the issues that are sectarian, religious there. Orthodox Christian versus Muslim, ethnic issues, but it's not just simply Christians versus Turks, as we know. That's Christian groups versus Christians, and Albanians versus everybody, and Bulgars versus everybody, and at various times. It's chaotic. Lots of political friction that is a constant low-level violence. Then the expression of this is, and when I talk about the, I'll wind this up in a minute, but this is a lead into Al's expertise in the Balkan Wars, the Turco-Italian War of 1911-1912. I covered that in one of the chapters of that Ataturk book. It's very poorly covered. I'd like to hear Al's comment on this if he's got one, in Western histories. For a number of reasons, but mostly, well, it's obscure. It was the Italians invading Libya. They don't do very well. They end up getting trapped on the coast by Turkish officers, largely leading Arab units with just and Berber, Arab and Berber irregulars, with some small number of Turkish regular troops that were in the in Libya when the Italians invaded in, what is it, September 1911. And the kickoff here is that Turkey cannot challenge the Italian navy. They have to sneak in through Anglo-Egypt, and they do make some arrangements where with the French are letting them have a telegraph line out of the town of Dohiba. I'm just adding this because it's Dohiba. That's where the Berbers got a lot of supplies. And then in the 2011 Libyan revolt against Gaddafi through the same town. But the Italians can blast the Turks at the beaches with their heavy guns, but they don't have the maneuverability or the expertise to really fight much beyond the escarpment along and go into the desert. However, it's the first air war. The Italians employ aircraft and dirigibles, small bombs and hand grenades dropped on Arab tribesmen riding on horses and camels and the like. Sidebar war, except the Greeks, Serbs, Bulgars, and Montenegrins see Turkey tied up, and they see it as their opportunity. And the political action is to form the Balkan League. And the Balkan League goes to war to really drive the Turks out of Europe. And so usually Balkan War I first and then Second Balkan War are seen as the two minor explosions leading to World War I, you've got to include there are three of them, the Turco-Italian War of 1911-1912. So that's you got to deal with some of the complications. I know I've been complicated here for the last 6 or 7, 8 minutes, but that's some of the deep background to August 1914.
Actually, when you say deep background, we could talk about Charlemagne if we wanted to.
I agree, Al. I mentioned 1453.
No, there's a point I want to make here.
Yeah.
When Charlemagne dies, the end result is that his empire is divided into three parts. And one of them becomes France, and one of them becomes Germany. And then there's this long strip in between that becomes Belgium and the Netherlands and Alsace and Lorraine and Switzerland and Italy.
Luxembourg.
Yeah, and these places, you know, we find Germany in its various guises and France in its various guises fighting over these places for the next 1,000 years or so. So, you know, this is a, it's the best phrase, I think, for the origins of World War I is organic. It just is there. It's built into the way that the continent's been developing for centuries. The odd thing is that in the century before 1914, you get what is possibly the most peaceful time in European history since the fall of Rome. Because with the collapse of Napoleon, everybody wants peace. The great powers, which still include France, even though, you know, they got beat by everybody else, set up a system to keep the peace. And you mentioned peacekeeping. They actually begin to do peacekeeping on a regular basis and holding meetings, you know, whenever there's a problem, because we don't want to go to war anymore. We've got enough trouble, you know, stomping on the liberals in our own countries who want constitutions and stuff like that, and coping with the unrest of the brought about the Industrial Revolution and that sort of thing. And so they really do, for about 99 years, promote peace. Now, the funny thing is, of course, as they promote peace, they also make war more likely. There aren't any big wars, but there are a lot of little wars. There's only three wars that actually involve the European great powers against each other in the entire 99 years, which is impressive. The Crimean War, the Austro-Prussian War, and the Franco-Prussian War, none of which degenerate into a, you know, Europe-wide slugfest, which is what happens in 1914. The trouble is that each time you settle a small problem, somebody comes away unhappy.
Well, Russo-Ottoman War, Bulgaria. I mean, there are numerous. When you're talking about, you know, Metternich's concert of Europe, and that is you're right. There is an attempt to mitigate and stop escalation. These conflicts, and I'll tell you that, you know, the Franco-Prussian War is really a major war.
Oh yeah,
it's a major war. But and they are fighting over, as you said, you know, deep roots on this Charlemagne, the Balkanization of Charlemagne's empire. If we're going to play, you know, Balkans on, but you do have this system, this Metternich system of trying to make arrangements and cut deals instead of killing one another. But the depth of my argument it's not mine. I do have a couple of little wrinkles to it about the decaying medieval empires. That definitely shows the depth on that. As much as you had, I know this sounds like an oxymoron, progressive czars. You had a couple, you know, an attempt to try to modernize Russia. And they were sort of modeling after some of the things the Germans were doing. You had arguably Archduke Ferdinand would pass for a liberal Habsburg. That sounds like another oxymoron, but they do exist. And you know, that's the way he saw trying to modernize. And then, but the Ottomans had been attempting had modernization element. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go back to the early 18th century. They'd been trying for 200 years because they knew they were behind technologically and the like. There you get into some of the issues we face now with militant Islam, because they had their own militants at that time. You know, these European inventions, they're suspect. God didn't give them to us, you know. That's the argument. And you had some Turks who were faithful Sunni Muslims saying, "No, we must modernize. This is this is the way to do that. It has there's no conflict between our religion and development of a steam engine, you know. But the religious militant doesn't see it that way.
Yeah.
But you have that's we look at the historical roots of it. What happens though is that the concert of Europe is breaking down. France and England almost have. I mean, this is something I know that you've addressed. A little war in the last decade of the 19th century. There are all these frictions breaking out between the great powers, and the greatest point of friction is in this mess and mire called the Balkans. It's not that the French don't want to take Alsace and Lorraine back, but
that's a longer term goal. We have a tendency to think of the French as lusting after Alsace Lorraine.
I quite agree.
But they it was something. Yeah, we would like to do this, but France is not going to undertake an aggressive war to do it, because even though they're allied with Russia, they understand that the odds are still against them. The thing is that happens here is the willingness of people to go to war existed. No one intended to go to war in 1914. Except that it happened because they were willing to go to war if they had to. And the damn fool thing in the Balkans, which is attributed to Bismarck, was what set it off, almost as an afterthought. Look at the assassination. Think about the assassination. Vrilo, who's the most influential teenager since Augustus, probably, kills the Archduke. And what happens? Well, immediately, not much. People are, there's expressions of sadness all across Europe. Something like 30 prominent world political or business leaders have been bumped off by assassins in the previous years. So that wasn't typically unusual. The Archduke wasn't all that liked by a lot of people, especially in Russia, because he did have some liberal tendencies, or he was suspected of having some liberal tendencies. Everybody went away. Everybody went on vacation. The Prime Minister of Serbia went on vacation. The Commanding General of the Serbian Army went on vacation to Czechoslovakia, what is now the Czech Republic. The Chief of Staff of the Austrian Army went on vacation. What happened? Everybody thought this could blow over. Just before he went on vacation, the Kaiser told the Austrians, we'll back you in whatever you do. And then he went on vacation because he didn't expect the war either. So how did the war come? And it happened because of some diplomatic blundering in Austria. The Austrians had been annoyed about the Serbs for a long time. And some people in Austria, in the Austrian government, decided to do something about Serbia. And they calculated that there would be no consequences. They'd smack down Serbia a little bit, the Russians would back off, and that would be the end of it. They issued an ultimatum to Serbia almost exactly a month after the incidents. By this time, everybody's on vacation everywhere. The headlines from the Archduke's assassination have disappeared. The ocean liners from the U.S. are carrying tourists to Europe like mad. No interruption in that. And suddenly the Austrians issue an ultimatum to Serbs. Well, the first thing the Serbs have to do is to go get the prime minister back. And the chief of staff of the army still doesn't come back. You know, he decides to wait it out. And the Serb ultimatum is a pretty horrendous document. I mean, it's very insulting. Something like 10 points, and they just get worse and worse. The Austrian ultimatum. The Serbs accept all but one of the points. They refuse to allow the Austrian police to enter Serbia to investigate whether they have government connections to the assassination. Now, probably that's because there were government connections to the assassination, at least indirectly. You had this rogue guy in the Serb intelligence system who had been in the habit of bumping people off. He bumped off the king and queen of Serbia about a decade earlier to install a new king and queen, new king anyway. Colonel Apis, his nickname was Apis. He was eventually shot by the Serbs. The Austrians hit upon this 1 out of 10, you know, rejection of 1 out of 10 clause to mobilize against Serbia. Meanwhile, the Kaiser's best friend is in London, and he's having dinner at one point with Winston Churchill. This is between the issuing of this ultimatum and 3 days later its rejection. It's minor partial rejection. This is Albert Behlen, who is the head of the Hamburg-America line, Jewish, even though the Kaiser is a notorious anti-Semite. He happens to be the Kaiser's best friend. And he basically tells Churchill what's going to happen now matter. It depends on what Russia does. The Russians, their reaction is to mobilize their army on the Austrian border. They're very careful about not ordering mobilization on the German border. The Austrians, well, they've got the Kaiser to back them up. Unfortunately, Kaiser's out at sea on his yacht and gets back, and it's too late. The Austrians are going, you know, they're going to go to the wall on this issue, and he has literally no choice but to sign the mobilization orders or see the Russians invade Austria and destroy the Austrians. And since Germany no longer has any allies, since he's pissed off everybody in Europe, he's even pissed off the Swiss, he has to go to war. And then it just falls into place.
Well,
Go
ahead and finish, and then I was going to point out something, though, about Serbian issues on this. But,
yeah. Then, of course, everything tends to become mechanical. The German war plan is mechanical. The government hasn't even been informed of the war plan. And they don't know that the war plan includes invading Belgium. They have a hint that it might, but no one has actually formally informed them of that. Secrecy is so tight that the German Navy doesn't even know that the German army plans to invade Belgium, which might have had some effect on the way the Navy acted. But all of these war plans are secret. This is something that nobody actually knows the details of anybody's plan, and in fact, nobody knows the details of anybody's alliances in most cases. Germany did not have to go to war with Russia. Germany was committed to defending Austria. Austria had just precipitated the war by attacking Serbia. Germany attacks France before they even attack Russia. And the dice begin to fall, and we have a war.
Well,
we have a war at the optimal time of year to have a war, too, which we can get to later.
Well,
yes.
Campaigning season of July, August, and September, because the weather's good. And,
well, there's three things, actually. The weather's good, obviously. The harvest is in. The potato harvest is in July or so. The wheat harvest is in August. The troops who've been furloughed to help with the harvest are back in the barracks, or can be called to the barracks very quickly. And the other thing is that the German army, and the French army too, actually, is at its strongest between April and October. Because you draft the guys in November. And you get, you know, so they're November, December, January, you know, February, March. They're in training. But beginning in April, well, they've had 5-6 months of training, you know. They're active troops now. That means you're going to discharge them in October. So August, September is the best time. You got the most fully trained troops available, and of course you can still recall the reservists, and you're going to be getting a big injection of conscripts, you know, come next month. So it's the optimal time to go to war, but it's also the only time that the war plan works. If the Schlieffen plan, which is the German war plan, which we can get to maybe next time, if the Schlieffen plan is going to work, it's only going to work in August and September, because the plan requires such a vast movement, it cannot be supplied by wagon or train if there's demolitions on the rail lines. So they have to steal from the local granaries and stuff, you know. Anyway, yes, Austin.
I was going to say, though, that, you know, when you know the Bosnian, we must look at the Bosnian crisis when Austria annexes yes. Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1908, which the Ottomans saw as, you know, that they were weak, helpless. I know they had been called the sick man of Europe 50 years earlier, but definitely the sick man of Asia Minor, because they'd been losing their European provinces and colonies. And actually, provinces is what they were. I mean, Albania is now a protectorate, and the Ottomans were fighting Albanian guerrillas, some of them Muslims, some of them Christians. You know, there are Christian Albanians in 1908, 1909, and 1910, and their own insurrection there. But when Austria-Hungary takes Bosnia, it not only offends the Ottomans, it offends Serbia and offends Russia right there. It offends the offends the Russians, and you see the component over a Balkan land grab by a declining major power.
It's even more complex if you think about it. Now think about this. The Triple Alliance, which binds Austria to Italy, has a clause that says if there are territorial rearrangements, if Austria expands into the Balkans, Germany will act as an honest broker to negotiate territorial compensation for Italy, which in effect is the Italia Irredenta territories that Austria controls. So now you've got the Italians saying, well, Austria, you just added this province. How about, you know, coming across with some of those Italian inhabited territories that you control? You know, we'll have a nice peaceful transfer of population, of government control, and our alliance will remain intact.
You're talking about the places like Spoleto on the Adriatic?
Well, Trentino. The Italians would specifically be interested in Trentino and Trieste.
No, so Austrians are not interested in that, because they've got their they see those as being Austrian territory.
Right.
On the other, but that's look, the Balkanization of northern Italy too, Princip is a member of a come on, Al, what's the name of the group? Young Bosnia. Young Bosnia, and it's Bosnian Serbs who covet the Serbian enclaves, and there's still a Republika Srpska now, a Serbian enclave, Bosnian Serb enclave. They resent the action by the Austrians. And, of course, the radicals are saying, you know, here's our chance, too, with the Ottomans being weakened. Maybe we, and Serbs have a substantial number of Serbs are interested in recovering their Iredenta.
Yes.
And that includes what they see, the parts of Bosnia. And mm-hmm. if the Austrians are going to take that, why can't they take that back? And the Austrians see, hey, this is an opportunity to slap down some of the Serbs because we can trace, you know, the conspiracy theorists, we can trace this assassination back to a component of Serbia, whether it's actually carried out by the Serbian intelligence or not on this. It's certainly, as you've written, that Serbian elements or elements in the Serbian army that were so ultra-nationalist, looking at those, they were foaming at the mouth to take control of these Serbian enclaves in Bosnia and Croatia and elsewhere, including parts of Albania and recovering that. And then and one other point, too, that Al, you made about not knowing what your ally is going to do. It's not clear that the Serbians knew what their ally, Montenegro, was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But what does Montenegro want? I know this is getting down, we're going down, but this is to a real magnifying glass on this. They want, what is it, Lake Scutari?
Lake Scutari.
That's what they want.
Yeah, they want Scutari. In fact, pretty much, I think the next to last peacekeeping operation under the old order, in effect, the Montenegrins occupy Scutari during the Balkan Wars.
Uh-huh.
And Serbia, and this is one of the last times that Serbia and Montenegro and Austria sort of get together, Serbia wants it. So Serbia now is at tension with its only ally in the region, and the Italians are ambiguous about it. The King of Italy is married to the daughter of the King of Serbia, of Montenegro. Guy did well for basically a hill bandit. He married kids off to every royal family in Europe, the King of Montenegro. So there actually was an allied force holding Scutari. Because remember, there's also Albania that wants it. There's an
that claims it. Albania says it's been stolen from us. Sure.
Yeah, there's a British, I think it's British, French, Austrian, I forget who else, force in there. Several hundred troops, a couple of thousand maybe. I can't remember whether the High Commissioner was British or not, to try and keep the peace. And, this is the phrase can of worms genuinely applies in the Balkans. Because every piece of real estate is claimed by someone else. In fact, it's very funny. In the post-war period, when they're trying to hold plebiscites and whatnot to decide some territories going from here to there, because the names of a province, the name of a province, what name you use for a province, can be politically sensitive. They actually revive some of the Roman names for some of the territories during the plebiscites. You can actually look, there's about 24 plebiscites in some of these regions, and you can actually see, you know, Pannonia suddenly appearing on the, you know, in the plebiscite, because if you used, you know, any other name, you would be using, you know, the Hungarian or the Romanian or the Polish or the whatever name for the province, and that would imply a lack of partiality, of impartiality. This is a unbelievable can of worms. It's just like the phrase, you know, the former Yugoslav Republic of
Macedonia. Or
that's how sensitive these people are.
Where is Northern Epirus, Al? Well, it's Southern Albania, Austin.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, and that's still going on. Yeah, exactly. But there's still a last estimate I saw, 35 or 40,000 Greeks living in villages inside Albania now, even though some of them have moved to other places since the end of the Cold War.
Austin and Al, we're starting to run out of time. There's two topics that I'd like to cover next time, and then we can probably get the war kicked off properly, and that's we haven't talked about the Concert of Europe and the balance of power and that whole concept, and we need to cover some of the major personalities a little bit and how they're all interconnected, but that's something we'll cover next time. Do you guys have anything you want to wrap this session up with?
Dan, let me put a wrap on it. Al talks about the can of worms. The listeners can say, gee, look at all the threads that Al and Austin went through. To tie it together. Take a look. You've got troops, peacekeeping troops, major powers supposedly trusting one another to try to act fairly. You see an assassination, you see subterfuge, and distrust explodes. That's one of the things. You didn't keep your word. The Germans see everyone acting against them. They have memories of losing opportunities to gain naval bases in the Mediterranean and in Africa. They're still smarting from that. Well, we can't have a navy. We can certainly have power on land. And Al was talking about some of the issues with the von Schlieffen plan. We'll certainly go into that. But take a look at this mess in the Balkans. Everybody's got land claims. Major powers have troops on the ground, and trust is evaporating. That's the end of the Concert of Europe.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen, and hopefully we'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll talk to everybody then.
Thank you, Dan.